All right. Today they have asked me to talk about Menger and the early Austrians. And of course, I only have 90 minutes to do that. Each one of these people that I'm going to talk about, Menger, Bombalvert, Wieser, and such, could easily have their own lecture or semester course. So let's just jump right into it. Karl Menger is the founder of the Austrian school. You can see the dates, 1843-1921. And before Karl Menger became a famous economist, he was a journalist for the Austrian cabinet. He used his experience observing price movements as the basis of his book, The Principles of Economics, right? It's 1871. So, 1871, born in 1840, so he was 31. Yeah, 31. So, that's your challenge. Write a brilliant book, found a school before you're 31. Now, it was upon the strength of this book that he was asked to tutor the Crown Prince of Austria, and he was also appointed initially as an assistant professor at the University of Vienna in 1873, so he was 33 years old. And then, of course, his academic career flourished. He was also well known for a couple of other things, such as having a very extensive library. Now, today we don't think of that as being such a big thing, but this is before the days of PDFs and Kindle and basically downloading a book. If you wanted a book, they were fairly rare and expensive, especially with overseas shipping. It's not like, you know, you buy something from Fee and then the next day you've got it. Buy stuff at Fee, you can get it the next day. And then he allowed a lot of people to use his own personal library, and he was very well known for that. There's also another story about him. When he was 70 years old, so about 1910, he asked for, and what he wanted, was a photograph of every living economist. And, well, that's what he wanted. And he was, you know, and he got them. And economists just started sending pictures to him. Indeed, every economist sent him a photo of themselves, except for one, his old nemesis, Gustav von Schmoller, who was the leader of the German historical school, or a branch of it. And we'll talk a little bit more about him later. Now, it is rumored, and I have no confirmation of this, but in the economic seminar room of John Hopkins University, you will see these photographs in their economic seminar room. Okay, it's in Baltimore, Maryland. And then his papers, the collection of his papers, are currently housed at Duke University in North Carolina. Now, Menger's major contributions to economic thought, I think, are the following. The development of marginal analysis, his victory in the Methoden Strike, the method war, the use of genetic causal approach of explaining social relationships, and his demonstration that money's origin is from the market. So let's take a look at the first one, marginal analysis and the marginalist revolution. And now the previous speaker, Dr. Larry White, did a fantastic job explaining the history and the importance of the marginalist revolution. And I don't want to completely repeat what he says, but I want to throw a little spin on it from more of a, you know, just Menger, not history of thought. Now, for the classical economists, the cost of something was seen as something real, by which was meant the quantity of labor invested in the product of a good or physical pain of human labor effort was devoted to the product of that good. In fact, it was argued that commodities only had value because their production required the burden of incurring costs. A commodity in general could have value only if it was scarce, and therefore labor had to be invested to supply or replace quantities of it. Now, Menger argued that commodities have value because people find them useful or desirable. Now, today we call that utility. However, usefulness is not sufficient. If quantities available exist in amounts sufficient to satisfy all the uses for the good or resource in question, then it does not have economic value. Right? It's the air in this room. There's no economic value. Why? Because I can have all I want and be satiated, and so can you. So a source to economic value is that there is a degree of scarcity. However, we don't compare all of one good relative to the value of all of another unit, right? This is the famous water diamonds paradox. So, what is precious for life? Water. Can you live without diamonds? Fergus, can you live without diamonds?
I don't have any diamonds.
So, yes. Yeah, always. See, this is why you always ask a guy. You know? So, can you live without diamonds? Yes, of course. Now, which is more valuable? If I had a cup of water here and a cup of diamonds, which is more valuable? No, right now. What would, you know, if diamonds, right? Now why? Because if one you'll die without, but yet we're not willing to spend that much money on. I mean, would you pay $5 for a glass of water? No, what would you do? You'd walk right over there to the own water cooler and pour yourself a cup. So why? Well, what Menger explains, and as do all the other marginal revolutionaries, they say that we're not supposed to compare all of this versus all of that. It's at the margin, meaning plus or minus one unit. What's the value of the next unit? So what's the value of the next unit of water? What's the value of the next unit of diamonds? And he did this analysis at the same time that two other people were doing it, William Stanley Jevons in England and Leon Walras in Lisieux, Switzerland, and basically they all independently came up with this same concept. And this is what we call the marginalist revolution. So the value associated with any particular unit depends upon the value of the next unit, the marginal unit. Now Menger and the Austrians went on to argue that cost is not labor quantity. Rather, cost is the marginal satisfaction of something else that is foregone, or has to be foregone, because the resources that might have produced this alternative were used to produce something valued, at the margin, more highly. So commodities have value, not because of labor input, but because we value, at the margin, what that use of labor and other resources can produce. So for Austrians, individuals choose from alternative desirable ends. That is, the achievement of this goal versus some other, the attainment of this end versus some other, or the satisfaction of this desire versus some other. Thus, the cost of a choice is the alternative end, goal, or desire that cannot be fulfilled because the means are insufficient in supply. Hence, the application of labor is a decision of how to use one of the means of production in the service of competing or alternative ends. And the value we assign to the quantity of labor required reflects the value of that end, and the end of that labor can help satisfy. The value of the means, labor, is derived from the value of the end. So, the classicals got it backwards. They were saying that it's because of labor, this has value. And what Menger and the Austrians are arguing is that the classical economists confused ends with means. Labor is a means, not an end, and therefore cannot by itself determine the value of that which labor helps produce. If labor is applied, it must be because it is considered valuable. Valuable in two senses. In the first sense, where the outcome, labor will help produce something, is considered valuable, and the second, in terms of what will have to be foregone because labor will not be available to produce some other thing or some other outcome. Okay, that's the beginning of the Austrian value theory, and we will see that that gets developed over the years. The next major thing, I mean, if you do one major thing, you think you've got a solid reputation and career. But Menger did like four. That's quite incredible. So the next major thing centers around this thing called the Methoden Strike. Now, quite literally, that means method war. So what's that? Well, it starts off with a publication in 1883, and it was translated back in the 1960s with this title, The Problems of Economics and Sociology. Now, there's a more recent publication of this same work, and don't ask me to say the German, because I will embarrass myself. But the new title is Investigations into the Method of Social Sciences, right? And that was much longer, so I thought I could just write the shorter, older one. Okay, this is that's my class A laugh material. If that's not funny, I've got nothing better. All right, so he does what? In 1883, he writes this book, and it's basically throwing down the gauntlet at the German historical school. Now, his nemesis, Gustav von Schmoller, wrote a review of Menger's book. And then in 1884, Menger responds to all of this in a pamphlet, which is The Errors of the German Historical School, or roughly translated like that. Now, the German Historical School, the GHS, had some divisions within them, but they shared a common belief that there were no universal laws of economics applicable for all men at all times in every country. The GHS called the classical economic theories English political economy. They argued that each historical period had its own laws of economic relationships, and that these so-called laws of economic relations are relative to the historical epoch of that time. These laws can change as the historical period changes. So for the GHS, the German nation and people had their own history, their own historical stages of development, and therefore their own laws of economics. England could argue that it was good for them at that time to follow a path of free trade, while Germany, within its own historical stage and economic laws, required protectionism and governmental intervention. For the German historical school, what was the purpose of theory and policy on the basis of this? Well, the answer is to serve the interests of one's nation, to make it strong and progressive. That's why the German historical school was doing what they were doing. The GHS accepted the socialist argument that class tensions existed, and the mercantilist argument that the interests of the individual may not be harmonious with the national interest. So therefore, what do we need? We need the state to intervene in economic and social affairs to minimize these class tensions and to regulate individuals in their economic activity to make sure that their actions are consistent with the national interests. So the GHS and Schmoller argued that the laws of economics were historically determined. Each stage of a nation's history dictated and required different economic relationships and institutional rules for contracts, for property rights, and so on. But Schmoller then parts ways with these guys, and he argues that there are no historically dictated stages of predetermined evolution. There was just this process of history. All one could do was sift through the historical artifacts of previous stages of one's national history and the facts of institution, the legal facts, the technological facts, the cultural facts of one's own time. And out of this, they would discover the theory. So the laws of economics that they would see seems to be only prevailing for that particular period of time. As a result, Schmoller then calls for a just relationship, or justice, relationship. And that's all, of course, defined by himself. It's like, I know what justice is. So he advocated the state, directed cartelization of industry, the establishment for welfare programs for the lower classes, and in general, the state must act as a paternalistic agent for all in the entire nation. Okay, so that's what Menger is up against. And it's this entire block of people arguing this against Menger. Right? German historical school, all these guys over here, Menger. He basically wages a one-man battle, a one-man war. And it was out of this war, and I think he won. Obviously, but I think he made these arguments that most economists today would say, economic laws are universal. But one last note on this Methodenstreit thing. The term Austrian was originally a sneer at the losers of the Battle of Königgrätz, which was in 1866, right? Germany won, right? So you've got these Austrians, right? It's just some backwater. They happen to speak German, but they're just Austrians over there. Well, what happened? Well, as happens frequently in history, the term was adopted by those who were being ridiculed by it, and they turned it into a positive banner. So now we wave the flag. Yeah, we're Austrians. Woo, look at us.
woo.
Well, one woo. That's good. All right. So Menger does what? He looks at the marginalist revolution, and he brings that forth. He wages this battle of the Matodan stripe, and the next big thing that we can attribute to Menger is this idea of genetic causal relationships. Okay, genetic causal relationships. Now, for Menger, the goal of an economic science is to demonstrate the process by which the complex phenomena of the market, like prices, wages, rent, interest, and so on, how these arise and are formed out of the actions and interactions of the simple elements. In other words, the individual actors. And these individual actors whose doings are the basis of all we see in the market. Okay, so how is it that you have all these individuals acting and reacting with each other? How do these then complex phenomena of the market emerge? Furthermore, the goal of analysis and study is to demonstrate how and why this happened, given that the institutions and phenomena of the market are most often the unintended consequences of actions of individuals. Now that's pretty key. It's the unintended consequence. Now we see this all the time in market relationships, right? No one entrepreneur wakes up early in the morning and goes, today I think I'm going to set my price equal to the equilibrium price, right? No one ever says that. So what's going on? How does this happen? Well, it's the unintended consequence of all of these actions. Right? That's what needs to be explained. And we see that this gets spun out more and more as there's more and more error. Like when we see perfect competition where everything is given. Hayek says, you know, that's pretty easy to do. If you've given everything and you just have to see where the two lines cross, well, of course that's where we're going to be. But here's the dirty little secret. All those lines that we see in those economics textbooks, yeah, they're not real. Right? What are they? They're just mental tools. They're just things that we use so that we can better understand the world around us. I can't actually measure a demand curve. Okay. So where would they intersect? I have no idea. So then what are we trying to explain? And it all comes right back to Menger. Okay. Menger argued that to understand the complex phenomena of the market and society in general, the analyst, that's us, must reduce the complex phenomena to the simplest elements still open to observation and study, and then show how out of the actions of the simplest elements that the complex phenomena emerge. Right, so what do we have? We've got elemental components of individual actors, and how do these guys merge, act, interact with each other to create this complex phenomena? How does that happen? That's what we're supposed to be examining. And so today we say that one of the founding principles is methodological individualism, because that's our basic component. Now, one has to establish the essential qualities of the elemental components, the qualities that make them what they are and to which, by their nature, they must conform. In completing this task, one then explains the process by which their interactions generate the complex phenomena. The demonstration of the causal process by which the market phenomena emerge, form, and modify through time. And it's from their genesis, their origin, in individual subjective decision-making that we start. So Menger's approach, and that of the Austrians that follow him, is sometimes called the causal genetic theory of market and price formation. Now, one of the best applications of this approach is shown by his demonstration of the origin of money. And that was published in English in the Economic Journal in 1892. It's called On the Origin of Money. I have my own money and business student, money and banking students, read this. And they say, why in the world are we trying to read something in clunky, old-school German over 100 years old. Because this is where it starts. Before Menger, if you asked Aristotle, the medieval scholastics, what's the origin of money? They all said the state. Comes from the state. It's a product of the state. See, here's the coin, there's the king's head. See, it comes from the state. If I ask my students that, they say basically the same thing. But what does Menger do? He says, no. Money cannot come from the state. It has to come from the market. And he shows in this article that no one sat down and invented money. Even if they know that all these transaction costs that are really high in barter would be slashed and reduced if we throw money into the mix. Says no one could do that. It evolved. It evolved like English, right? Nobody sat down and said, you know, a great way to communicate thoughts would be through this thing called language. I should invent that, right? Nobody did this. So then, where did it come from? Well, he says it's organic. Right? It's organic. Menger showed how individuals, each acting according to their limited information and heterogeneous goals, different goals, what would they do? They would trade their stuff, their wares, for something that's more saleable. Something that's more tradable. Why? Because it's in their interest to do that. He's showing that each individual actor is going to behave in a certain way. And then he says, well, if that guy's accepting this other sort of commodity, what does that mean to me? How does that affect how I see the good, how I perceive it? And what we see is then this stepwise approach in showing what? That the most saleable commodity would take on the function of the medium of exchange. Money. That money comes from the market. That it doesn't come about any other way. Now, Hayek will emphasize this approach, this process, and popularize it, and today it's called spontaneous ordering. And I'm quite sure we're going to hear a whole bunch more about that later on this week. But this is where it starts. It starts in Menger. Now, Menger had two brilliant students, and I didn't write them up here. So I'm going to make some space. The first one is Eugen von Bombalverk, 1851 through 1914. The second one is Friedrich von Wieser. I'll get to him in a minute. In the previous lecture, we got to see nice pictures of him. And I only have props. And this is Menger's book, right? It's not very colorful. But there's a picture of Bombalverk in here, see? Maybe the camera will close in or something. But it's the same picture, right? Now, Bombalverk and Wieser, they never actually studied under Menger. What'd they do? They read his book. They read his principles book. And they became his greatest followers. And then they became... Bombalverk, Wieser, and Menger became the core of what's called the Austrian school. Or back then, sometimes it was called the psychological school or the subjectivist school. Now, what's so important about Bombalverk? Well, Bombalverk was well known for many things, but let's give a little history of him, a little personal note. He was married to Wieser's sister. So yes, they were brothers-in-law, and Bombalverk was married to Wieser's sister. And also, Bombalverk was Mises' teacher. He graduated and then first taught at the University of Innsbruck, and then he moved on to the University of Vienna. Interestingly also, he was Schumpeter's teacher. Joseph Schumpeter. We'll talk about him in a couple later lectures. Bombavrik also said that you should always keep a book at hand, especially if you're waiting for your wife. You'll get a lot of reading done. And I've learned that that was true. Very true. He was a finance minister twice. The first part is a caretaker cabinet in 1890, and then again in 1900 and 1904. According to Mises, the principles that Bombavrik held while he was in office were a strict maintenance of the legal fixity, fixed gold parity of the currency, and a balanced budget without any aid from the central bank. Those were his two things, and he stuck to them. Now, he's famous for his work in Capital and Interest, and it came in three volumes. So here's volume one. And volume one came out in 1884, and the title is A History and Critique of Interest Theories. And in this, he presents an in-depth theory of interest and capital theory. He's looking at the history. And so then 5 years later, he comes out with volume two, The Positive Theory of Capital. Curiously, they look the same. No. And in this one, he puts forth the Austrian theory of capital and interest. And then here's volume three, which came out in 1896. So these are the rebuttals and responses to critics. The final version was published in 1914. And then he had other books, such as Karl Marx and the Close of His System. And we've gathered and translated many of his essays. And this is the shorter classics of Bombavrik. And it's really interesting reading. Now, he writes like a German from the 19th century. Why? Because he was a German in the 19th century. Which means what? Long sentences. So it takes some getting used to. But it's well worth it. Now, Bombavrik made many important contributions to the field of economics. He helped draw out and clarify the underlying subjectivity of value and how it's at the margin all decisions are made. It was through his analysis that he attacked Marxism, right? And he says Karl Marx in the close of his system, right? He's like closing the book, closing the chapter. It's done. Never to come back again. Well, that was 1896. But he shows that Marxism was fundamentally flawed. And then he's contributed in the areas of law and economics, and even addresses the issue of intellectual property rights. I know. Can you believe that? Just so you know, he was against copyrights and patents. So there you have it. Now, he is perhaps best well known for his contribution to the areas of capital and interest, and his three large volume work was a must-read for anyone doing research in those fields for half a century, 70 years. Now, I argue that it still should be, but I don't get to make those sorts of rules. I don't know why. All right, so let's look at the field of capital theory. Now, Bombavrik builds upon Menger. Menger made the distinction between higher-order goods, which means earlier stages of production, and lower-order goods. That's the stages of production close to the consumers. Bombavrik argued that there is a definite time element and a structure to the production process. Now, he gets into this debate with John Bates Clark, who's over here in the U.S., over capital theory. And then essentially, a few years later, he gets into this exact same argument over the same issues yet again. And then in the 1930s, Hayek gets into the exact same argument over the exact same issues with Frank Knight at the University of Chicago. Now, when Menger's book, Principles of Economics, is translated into English, in the first edition, you'll see an introduction by Frank Knight. The second edition has an introduction by Hayek. Why the switch? Because Knight's introduction is one of the most vicious introductions I've ever seen in any book. You know, applauding the book. You know, no, he was like, grr, Menger and capital theory. He was just like, what? It's interesting. Now, it was Bombavrik's position that since production was through time, that there was this structure of production. In other words, in order to make this podium here, what do I have to do? I have to cut down the tree. And then I take the tree to a sawmill. And then I take it to a manufacturer. And then it goes to a wholesaler. And then it goes to a retailer. And then, as a consumer good, it's purchased. Right? There's a structure to production. And Bombavrick then, in his book, presents a diagram of expanding concentric circles. Now, Hayek later takes that diagram and turns it into a triangle. Now, we'll see a bit more of that in the business cycle lecture I'll give on Thursday. Now, Bombavrick went so far to get himself into some analytical trouble because he was pushing his positive analysis, and he proposes that we can actually calculate an average period of production. Well, Austrians today just say, no, we don't actually believe that. And then I have to put a little footnote there, because not all Austrians say it. There's actually a group in Europe, Malte Faber, is a neo-Austrian. They say we're out of the roots of Bombavrick, but they're highly mathematical, and they're attempting to actually calculate these things, such as average periods of production. And even though they call themselves neo-Austrians, they really don't mix and mesh with what we in the U.S. Generally accept as contemporary Austrian economics. It's just a completely different branch. Okay, back to Bombavrick. So Bombavrick says that there's a structure of production, that there's a definite sequence. So what's he arguing with, right? Of course you got to cut down the tree before you can have a podium. You can't go flipping them around or anything, like podium, then cut down tree. No, it doesn't work that way. So what's the other side say? Well, Clark argues that capital could be viewed as this homogeneous blob of K. Literally, blob, K. And it's constant. Now, it can be shaped and molded into anything. So he gives this example of a whaling ship being transformed into a shoe factory. Now, how in the world do you do that? Well, you know, as you use this whaling ship, two things occur, right? The whaling ship is earning returns, and then we take that money and we start funding it to build the shoe factory. And then secondly, as the ship is wearing out, it's depreciating. So at the end, the capital is fully transferred and transformed from the whaling ship into the shoe factory at the end of that process. Furthermore, Clark denied the need for the time element. Time? We don't need time. He claimed that time was needed to get the shoe factory up and running, but once it was running, no waiting was required. As long as there's continuous input, stuff going in, that we can have continuous outputs. I stick the raw materials at one end, and out comes shoes simultaneously from the other end. Why do I have to wait, right? No waiting, just boom, boom. Now, he called this synchronicity. Now, this went around and around in journal article after journal article through multiple rounds. And Bombavrick then says that Clark is arguing by analogy. And then he said this, and this is a gem quote. There seems to dwell in the human heart an enervating proneness for playing the poet in matters of science and for placing by the side of the common natural things and forces with which we have to do in the world of prose visionary doubles in the form of all sorts of mystical beings and powers to which a semblance of reality is imparted by means of an elegant abstraction. I hold this practice to be fraught with gravest danger to science. If one departs from the bare truths of nature by only a hair's breadth, scientific accuracy of thought is irretrievably lost. The sway of truth gives place to that of words and sounding phrases. And that's Bombavrick in Quarterly Journal of Economics in 1895. So, finally, Bombavrick argued that in order to increase production, the capital structure, then, would have to become more roundabout, more complex. Now, roundaboutness, clunky phrase, you'd think after a couple hundred, you know, after 100 years and some, we'd come up with a better term. No, not our comparative advantage, I guess. Roundaboutness is an essential concept in Austrian capital theory, and I'm going to talk a bit more about that in the business cycle lecture. So, let's switch gears, and let's take a look at his interest rate theory. So in 1889, he comes out with Volume 2. Oops. Volume 2, right? I don't know. They're all the same. I could pick up any of them. You wouldn't tell. And the first English edition was published in 1891. And here he advances a positive time preference approach to interest. The clearest example of the statement is the following. Present goods have in general greater subjective value than future and intermediate goods of equal quantity and quality. And since results derived from the ascribing of subjective value determine objective exchange value, present goods have in general greater exchange value and a higher price than future and intermediate goods of the same kind and number. Yes, for Bombavrick, that is a clear statement. It's good stuff. It just takes a while. It's slow reading. Now, Bombavrick allows elements of productivity theory to reappear when he starts looking at the lengthening of the average period of production. And finally, in all of these pages, he settles on three causes for the theory of interest. First one, he says, present wants are more intense than future wants. And that might be because earning capacity might be greater in the future. It might be because people are worried about getting ill in the future. Or the holder of durable asset is at liberty to use it either now or in the future. And money in particular is durable and cheap to store, so it is a way of keeping one's options open. And the second reason is that people tend to underestimate future wants relative to present wants because they might lack imagination or willpower or are uncertain about their lifespans. And then the third reason, he says, is that present goods have a technical superiority over future goods. It's a roundaboutness is productive. Now, there's a dispute that rises, and it's centered on this last category. Now, in volume one of his book, that's this one, Bombavrick says what? He says, productivity theory of interest, wrong. No. Mm-mm. Can't do it. And then in volume two, okay, it's the same book. Fine. Volume two, he presents, I mean, they look the same. You never know. Gotta have props. You know. I don't have this fancy PowerPoint. Maybe I'll whip something up for Thursday. He presents a productivity theory as a big component in the formation of interest rates. So, the third reason is obviously Bombavrick's lapse into a productivity theory of interest, right? Well, Lord Robbins, Lionel Robbins, becomes the Lord, explains Bombavrick in the following manner. He says this, some people have thought, and in my judgment, not entirely without justification, that Bombavrick was really letting productivity in by the back door, having, so to speak, with oaths and with curses, turned away productivity out by the front door. He denounced it in the terrific passage of the first volume of Capital and Interest, page after page after page, denouncing all productivity theories. Sounds like a paradox. Now, after discarding a productivity theory of interest in the first volume, he not only allows it to resurface in his own positive theory, Hayek in The Pure Theory of Capital argues that Bombavrick characterized time preference as subordinate to the determinant of the formation of interest rates in the short run. Now, it's my contention that the Bombavrickian paradox, that'll work, doesn't really exist, because Bombavrick was actually asking two separate questions. In the first volume, Bombavrick was asking an essentialist question. Bombavrick was exploring the origin and fundamental core of the formation of interest rates. In other words, he was examining the necessary and sufficient conditions for the formation of interest rates. What does it take to get an interest rate? Do you need productivity? No, he says no. In the second volume, Bombavrick was not only asking what are the necessary and sufficient conditions, but he's also asking what influences the height of interest rates. What's a factor? What's a major player? Why do we see interest rates where they are? And so what we see are two separate questions. And I find that fairly interesting that We still have that sort of debate going on in the Austrian school. Okay. Now, let's take a look at von Wieser. Okay, so we've got Menger, who writes his book in 1871, and basically launches the Austrian school. Now these two guys, they don't take a class from him. Right? They're not at the University of Vienna. But what happens? They read his book and they're swayed by his ideas. And they become brothers-in-law, right? Bavarch marries Wieser's sister. And they are fairly close in what they're talking about. So it's the subjective value theory that we see in Menger and also in Wieser we see in Bavarch. But it's not as strong. We see these are complementary things. So the strengths of Bavarch are supplemented by Wieser, I guess is what I'm saying. And the strengths of Wieser are supplemented by Bavarch. So they're all sort of reinforcing each other. And that's why we tend to think of the core, the beginning, the founding of the Austrian school as Menger, Bavarch, Wieser. Okay, that's why they're important. Now, Bavarch was Mises' teacher. He was also Joseph Schumpeter's teacher. Now, Friedrich Wieser was Hayek's teacher and also this guy named Hans Meyer. Okay, now Hans Meyer started as an Austrian and then sort of changed his stripes as time went forward, right? First he was, I don't have to get into all that. Anyway, Wieser. He started off at the University of Prague and then he moved over to Vienna. In his first book, Natural Value, was published in 1889. And in this he invents the term marginal utility. Okay, so 1889, I should write that down. He invents the term marginal value and put forth the idea of opportunity cost. Okay? Now, that's pretty key. That's really important. The Austrian school is labeled the subjectivist school because, and this is a little bit of what we talked to, or was discussed in the first lecture, where you have Marshall, right? Alfred Marshall is talking about what creates the price. You've got a pair of scissors, right? Which blade cuts the paper? It's the interaction between supply and demand. Well, what we see in Marshallian economics is the demand side, which is mostly subjective, supply side, which is mostly objective. But here, what we see is the rejection of that. So we have the demand side, which is subjective, and the supply side, which is subjective. Well, how does that work? I'm looking at the price formation of something, right? And I see that I have on one side, what is my demand for that aluminum? Right? And the entrepreneur has to think about how much he's willing to pay. Well, he's projecting into the future what he thinks his project is going to earn, what it's going to yield. And it's based upon that, he's able to say, this is how much money, dollars, I'm willing to spend on that aluminum. Simultaneously, other businessmen are doing exactly the same calculation. And so what we have to do is bid that aluminum away from its next best alternative, the next best opportunity. Right? In other words, it's opportunity cost. Now, what is that? Well, that's what other people are demanding. So what's the supply curve? The supply curve isn't this objective thing, how many widgets are there or how much aluminum there is. The supply curve is what? It's what other people's composite demands are for it. And do we care about all the demands? No, just the ones at the margin. And so it's the subjective demand side against the subjective supply side. And it all starts here. In 1914, he writes another book called Social Economics, and that's a fairly comprehensive treatise. And then in 1926, The Law of Power comes out. But his most significant contribution is the stuff on foregone opportunity. In fact, it's so important that they start calling it Wieser's Law. Now, Wieser's Law is this. The cost of any one economic activity or activities is the foregone products that may not be produced because the resources available for production activities are devoted to the production of some other goods. Okay? Let me repeat that nice and slow. Okay, what's Wieser's Law? The cost, the true cost of any one economic activity or activities is the foregone products that may not be produced. Why? Because the resources available for that production, they've gone somewhere else. They're devoted to some other production activity. So when I go to the store and I have a dollar and I want to buy this Mountain Dew here, what's the cost of the Mountain Dew? It's not the dollar. What? It's not the dollar. I thought you just spent a dollar on Mountain Dew. I did, but that's not the cost. That's the price. What's the cost? The cost is the next best thing I could be doing with that dollar. Maybe it's buy a bag of chips. Right? So when we're looking at the costs of things, it's how people view the object. It's how people use the object. Okay? Do you see what's going on here? Right? So it's subjective versus subjective. And as a result, the Austrians get labeled as the subjectivist school or the psychological school. Why? Because it's all here. Now, In the last lecture, they talked about the Mises Circle and some of these other frothings of intellectual curiosity going on in Vienna around the turn of the century. But it wasn't just economics, right? This is when Sigmund Freud was around, coming out with his ideas, right? So this idea of psychology and what's going on in the gray matter all becomes really interesting to a lot of people at this time. And so to be called the psychological school or the subjectivist school was a radical sort of notion, and it wasn't just some, you know, oh, we're putting them down. Now today, you have a lot of mainstreamers, and I'll talk about this in my last lecture, and they say, oh yeah, we've incorporated all that utility stuff. We've incorporated all that subjective stuff, but truly, they haven't. They haven't. They're still using Marshall's scissors, objective versus subjective. The Austrian school is radically different. Do you guys see how different that is than what you typically see in your standard textbooks? Right? Especially if you're building your supply curves based upon your marginal cost curves, and all of those come from objective given costs. Right? Or that kind of just an objective given cost. It's the price of this, the price of that. Right? Completely antithetical to what we're doing. Now, building on Wieser is this guy named David Green. Now, David Green writes in 1894... in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, an article called Pain Cost and Opportunity Cost. And this was the first to actually use the phrase opportunity cost. Right, we see it in all the basic textbooks, but what's he doing? He is taking Wieser's idea and coins the term opportunity cost. And he reformulates it in an even more subjectivist way, more so than Wieser does. He takes it a step further. He argues, Green, argues that the cost is based upon the chooser's point of view. Right? So not only is the cost not just an object, there's no objectivity coming in, but it's not something objectively observable. Right? Because what's my cost if I buy this Mountain Dew with this dollar? Only I know. Right? It's the next best thing I would choose. Right? It's not an objective thing. So, in essence, then, the cost of an action is a might have been. It's the next best choice before the actor that is not chosen. Thus, the cost of the choice is purely based upon the future. And because the future is changeable, it's also completely subjective. Okay? So it's based upon this future choice, right? Because what's all the stuff in the past? Well, how many of you guys have time machines and can go backwards in time and change things? Anyone? No, because otherwise you'd be like, what am I doing here? So what is it? That's something in the past. We can't change it. So that's a sunk cost. Right, that sunk cost then integrates well with the Austrian school, because the Austrians saying that everything in the past is no longer part of our future choice, right? So if I bought, say I bought General Motors stock a year ago for $35. All right, maybe not GM. Get mad at me. All right, $135. IBM. There, how about that? So a year ago. And today it's trading at, I don't know, let's just say about 105. I think I saw it on the ticker at 106 or something. So 105. Now, it's gone down. About $30 a share. And suppose I spent $10,000 on it. Ooh, okay, so I took a hit. About 30% hit. A little less than that. But what are my choices? What can I do with this stock? What are my choices? I could sell it, okay. I could hold. Or I could do what? I could buy more. Now, in order for me to sell, what do I have to expect the future price to do? Go down. Okay. In order to encourage me to buy, what do I have to expect the price to do? Go up. And if I'm uncertain if it's going to go up or down, I might just hold. But notice that each and every one of these decisions does not look at the past. Each of those ignores the past. Each of those look at the sunk cost as completely sunk. It's in the past. We can't change it. I've already incurred that cost. The milk has been spilt. Quit crying. Go clean it up. Okay? So the Austrian perspective is entirely future-oriented. The notion of cost is future-oriented. It's standing in today and looking into the future. That's how we're calculating it. Okay, just a few more points, then I'll take questions. Also in 1894, this guy named Herbert Davenport, writes an article in the Journal of Political Economy called Cost is Displaced Cost. Then in 1908, he writes a book called Value and Distribution, and then 1913, The Economics of Enterprise, and I saw them hanging on the shelves over here so you can take a look at them. And in these, he develops a theory along the lines of Philip Wicksteed, where he's talking about reservation demand and reservation price concepts. Now, what is that? It's another way of looking at supply, right? Instead of looking at demand and supply, he says we look at it as terms of demand and reservation demand, or reciprocal demand, right? If I have 3/4, what's the reciprocal of 3/4? 4/3, right? You're just flipping it around. So when I go to the store and I demand Mountain Dew, what am I doing? I am supplying dollars. when the guy on the other side of the counter is supplying Mountain Dew, what's he doing? He's simultaneously demanding dollars, right? There's a reciprocal there. And so what's going on is when we trade, it's not just demand, but it's demand and, or, I'm sorry, not just demand and supply, but it's demand and reservation demand. Okay. Now, I've got one last author I'd like to present to you, and his name is William Smart. Now, William Smart was the first to translate Bombavrik into English, Capital and Interest into English. These libertarian press were translated in the 1950s by Senholtz, and I think there was another person. This one just says Senholtz. But William Smart, I think, had a bit more of a talent with the English, and I actually enjoy reading the Smart translation a little bit more. I think he also translated Natural Value. Let me take a quick look. Look at that, edited with a preface and analysis by William Smart. So who was this William Smart guy? Well, he wrote this little teeny tiny book, right? See how thick that is? Even you guys could read that. I'd like to assign it to my undergrads, right? It's only a mere, it's not even 100 pages. Oh, it's 102 pages. But that's including the stuff at the beginning. So 100-page book, what is it? It's called An Introduction to the Theory of Value. Okay, it was first published in 1891. Now, it's in PDF form, so go get it, go read it. It's an excellent little concise book on Austrian value theory. When he says it's an introduction to value theory, that's exactly what it is. And he's doing it along the lines of Menger, Bombavrik, and Wieser. Now, these guys were brilliant economists who founded the Austrian school. Okay. Now, they didn't intend to create a separate school. It came out of the unintended consequences of their actions. Now, one of the other things that I noticed is that we Austrians, we tend to read our founders, our classics. And I think if we ask your regular grad student in econ, have you read Marshall? Probably won't get such a high percentage of yeses as you would if you ask Austrians, have you read Menger or Bombavrik or looked at Wieser? And I think we're a better school because of it, because it puts it into a much broader context that Austrians tend to appreciate that truth isn't found in just the last couple of years of journal articles, right? Truth is much, much more than that. So let me end on that and saying that we're a better school, because we are. And I'll take questions. So I talked for my hour and 2 minutes, and we have a half hour of questions. Go ahead.
You were using the aluminum as an example.
Yes.
You mentioned the opportunity cost of the aluminum. Are you saying that products have an opportunity cost as far as where they go as well?
Okay, does the aluminum in my example have the opportunity cost? Well, it's more of a turn of phrase than actually saying that the cost is in it. But it's different people bidding for that resource, and I have to bid it away from some other entrepreneur.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's just the way that you worded it. It almost sounded like you were saying the aluminum, like...
Yeah, the aluminum doesn't actually choose, right?
Yeah.
Right, now the aluminum is not an actor. It doesn't choose, and the only way that you incur a cost is by choice. It's okay, by foregoing some other opportunity. Yes. No, he was awesome. I completely agree with everything Dr. White said on everything.
Okay.
He is sitting right there. You see that, right?
Right.
I always learned something from him, and before I came here, I listened to his lecture on free banking that he presented last year, and I downloaded it into my MP3 player, and cut the grass with it, but it was great. And one of the things is that the Austrians are not all in lockstep. We tend to agree on most things because we're Austrians. Are there some things that we disagree on? I'm sure there are, right? But I haven't asked them on a lot of things, right? So I don't know. But I'm not looking for a fight. I'll lose. Yes?
So you said that the Austrian school usually reads the people that started it. Is that actually a good thing? Because doesn't that mean that there hasn't been better put versions of their stuff? Like, for example, in more scientific classes, then usually, you know, you read the most up-to-date stuff instead of reading the starting stuff.
Okay, so the question is,
is it actually a good thing?
Is it actually a good thing that we read all the old stuff? Because by golly, shouldn't we have figured out a better way of explaining it by now?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, yes and no. There's some things like roundaboutness, which I think we should have improved upon in terms of phraseology, but we didn't, and I don't know why. But yeah, absolutely. We have improved on the way that we communicate these ideas, but I think there is a richness in reading the earlier works and sort of a rediscovery of some of their thought processes. Look, people forgot all about the Austrian school until the revival in the mid-70s, when that revival occurred, everyone kind of heard of Hayek because he just won a Nobel Prize. But who is this Mises guy? Oh, he's Hayek's teacher, so he must have said everything that Hayek has said, and there must be nothing original in Mises. So what do? Well, you go back and you read them. Now, the downside of all of this is that you have a stack up to here that's sitting by your bed that you have to read. But on the positive side, you've got a stack up to here of all the cool stuff that you can read. So, it's a horrible blessing that we have. Yes, Jonathan.
Do you feel that the inherent distinction between Austrian economics and the mainstream school is detrimental to the cause? Because I think a lot of times distinctions between different classes of thought can lead to sort of the type of idea when they're like because it's not in the mainstream, they're like, oh well, don't even talk to those guys, just stick with
so whatever. because we're disagreeing with another school on its point of view, that we're not able to integrate.
No, I'm saying, like, do you think the label Austrian economics
does the label
positive, or does it carry with it,
well, it started, does the label of Austrian economics, is it purely positive, or does it have any? Well, yes. I mean, it started off as a dispersion.
Right.
It's like you're just piddly little Austrians, right? Go away, right? We're Germans. We won a war. You know, we fought in the Battle of Königgrätz. You know, duh, we're awesome. That's a controversy going on, I guess, in Austrian economics, and it will always go on as long as there is this thing called Austrian economics. You know, should we integrate more with the mainstream, or should we be proud of our differentiation? I know later on this week I'm going to talk about all the distinctions between Austrian economics and the mainstreams, and both micro, and I've got like a list of 9 things. And then in macro, it's the Austrians, and we've got the Keynesians, the monetarists, the new Keynesians, the new classicals, the monetary disequilibration theorists, the real business cycle theorists. But I think more fundamentally, if we look at how Austrian economics has grown, it's grown out of debate, argument. Right? Where was Menger the best? Well, you could say his first book was really good, but he had a one-man war in the Methodenstreit. If you look at Bombaverk, where is he the best? Well, he's the best when we're looking in Capital and Interest in Volume 1, where he's just arguing against everyone, saying everyone in the world is wrong except for me. And then in Volume 3 here, he's arguing against all of his critics. If you look at all of his work, right, where is the dynamic? Where does it come from? It comes from this debate, right? And then jumping ahead, if you look at the socialist calculation debate, where do we really define and refine many of our fundamental notions? It's through controversy. So should there be more controversy? Yeah, because it furthers the science. And then in the end, they will all agree with us because we're right. Okay, you already asked a question, but there was someone. Okay. Yeah. No, well, either one. Go ahead. Fight it out.
Where do you see the points of objections or criticisms with Austrian economics? Like, we're all sitting here, we're all, you know, partaking in this seminar, but where do you see the weaknesses associated with Austrian economics? Why would someone agree with us?
That's a hard question for me, because I've never not been an Austrian.
Well, it's the same thing as me, so that's why I'm asking.
Well, I mean, when I went to undergrad at Hillsdale, one of my first teachers, Ed Facey, was studied under Mises, and then Richard Ebeling, and he's a big Misesian, and it's I never had a chance to know otherwise. And so maybe people were once, you know, in the neoclassical realm and then discovered Austrian economics might be able to point that out, or people who are still in neoclassical world might do a better job. I think people disagree with us because we don't have as convincing empirical evidence as they might like. When I was in grad school, Jaeger was always, Leland Jaeger is a monetary disequilibrium theorist and brilliant guy. He's like, well, Austrians, with your business cycle theory, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence, right? And we would point to this Charles Wainhouse thing back in 1986, and you know, like, well, there's an article that once looked at empirics, right? So we need to shore up, you know, the statistics to back up our arguments, and I think we're doing that now, because I mean, if you think about 1972, how many Austrians were there? And now think about the number of Austrians today publishing, and some of it is fairly rich in its econometric work, but it's also doing it in the proper context. What's the relationship between theory and data? And it's the application of theory so that we better understand the data, right? It's that tracing it down to its causal, its genetic causal elements, right? Those bases, and then working our way up. So I don't know where our fundamental flaw is, because I don't see it. But that's a question you could ask every single person here and get a different answer with. So, but you can ask it over and over. That's a great, you know, that way you have your stock question. The whole week. All right, and behind him. How does Austrian economics work with prediction, is what you're asking?
Yeah, because it seems like the psychological value comes from an individual.
Right, okay. So we've got all these everyone's valuing their own thing, and we have no idea of who values what, because we can't crawl into someone else's mind, and so therefore we have no idea how much they're valuing it, right? So how can we make any sort of prediction or do any sort of analysis? Well, in our approach, what we do is we do what we can with what we have, right? We start with the human action axiom. This is people behave purposefully, right? It's not random behavior. And we also live in a world of scarcity. So based upon those two things, I can deduce that we have a preference scale. And it's from that, working down the preference scale, I could deduce the law of diminishing marginal returns, and from that, demand curves. On the other side, I can work up the preference scale and deduce the law of increasing opportunity cost and something like a reservation demand curve or a supply curve. And from that, I create a model of a market. Now, I take that model of the market and I apply it to the world around me so I can better understand what's going on. It is through that analysis where I know that as long as I haven't made a mistake in my logical steps, in my deduction, that I have a model with a truth value of, yes, it's true. And so then I can apply that out there because there are just too many variables for me to understand what's going on with the price of gasoline. So if I ask, if we change this, or if this occurs, right, if we pass a minimum wage law, what are going to be the implications of that? And yes, we're starting from a radically subjective starting point, but nevertheless, these subjective values are real, and we can make real deductions from it, create usable models, and then make policy conclusions or interpret history. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. There was someone over... No? Okay, go ahead.
My question is kind of to bite off of his. It says, do you think that the Austrian school will ever find a way or should find a way to dumb down the basics of the philosophy to reach a wider audience? Because the Keynesian school talks about government programs and all that, and people just hear, okay, government's going to take care of it, so let's let them do it.
You think should we dumb down the philosophy so that more people
down,
get it?
Just send the basics so people understand it, because it's mostly among intellectuals. It's a lengthy task just to learn everything that goes with it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It is a lengthy task to get. And Henry Hazlitt talks about this in the first chapter of Economics in One Lesson. Right, he says you've got the seen, right, and he's borrowing from Bastiat, and then you've got the unseen. And he says sometimes it's argued that the bad economist is able to present their half-truths so much better than the good economist can present their truths. Well, he says, why? Well, the reason is because you got to supplant the other half, right? You have to show the unseen. And in order to do that, that usually takes a long, boring chain of reasoning that just puts your audience to sleep. Right, that's the uphill battle we have to climb. So what do we do? Well, we attack on every front in every way we can. Okay, we need the high intellectual stuff. Right, we need the top level intellectual stuff. But then we also need people like Frederick Bastiat, who is a great and sarcastic popularizer of the free market, wonderfully sarcastic. You know, he argues, hey, I think we should black out all the lights because that way we candle makers will benefit, right? I mean, that's the sort of sarcasm that we need. And who's going to do that? Well, all of us, right? There's no central plan for freedom. Who's going to do all of it? All of us have to do it, right? And so maybe some of us can do some things on YouTube, and other people are going to be able to write some op-ed pieces, and other people are going to blog, and other people are going to do this. And how do you convince people, right? Rarely do you convince people with logical argumentation. You got to hit them sometimes right in the gut. You know, it's like, look at what you're causing all these people over here. Look at that misery that socialism does, right? You're not feeding these people because of price controls, right? And we need to hit at all levels in order to convince people. Now, having said all that, what am I doing? I'm advocating. Right? Now, I'm not being a social scientist when I'm saying this, okay? If I'm being a pure economist, it's a value-free science, right? There have been socialist Austrian economists, right? There have been a few left-wing Austrian economists out there. So as a science, we're not advocating a particular thing. We're trying to understand the different causal relationships of how the world fits together. Yes, go ahead.
You can't have a socialist Austrian economist. That sounds like an oxymoron. Isn't that essentially the state controlling the market, which is not a free market?
Yep.
Okay. So how
did they do that? Well,
this
one guy in the 1930s, his name was M.A. Abrams, and he wrote a little book. And the first, I think, five chapters explain Austrian business cycle theory as well as anyone could. And so in chapter 6, I think, he basically says, so the problem is that we've got this boom bust, this artificial boom, all this malinvestment, so what we need to do is simply socialize investment, and that will take care of it. No more malinvestment. That was his answer, right? So was he a lefty socialist and an Austrian? Yes, yes. So, and there have been a few others. Not too many, but there have been a few. Yes, behind.
What relationship is there between the collapses of communist communism in the 90s and the rise of populism and the popularity of the Austrian school?
What's the relationship between the relationship between... I'm repeating the question because I have a big sign here that says repeat the question. What's the relationship between the collapse of communism and the interest in the Austrian school? Well, given that there's such a lack of empirical work, well, I think Peter Bedke's dissertation is on the collapse of the Soviet economies from an Austrian perspective, and the Austrians have been predicting the collapse. And I think maybe in the socialist calculation debate we're going to talk about the Soviet collapse a bit, so I don't want to go too far into it. But there has been a big resurgence in... maybe not the popular press, but you'll see it in maybe the business magazines, maybe like Barron's and those sorts of things, Investor Business Daily newspaper, of, hey, maybe these Austrians are on to something. Maybe their business cycle does seem to, you know, make a whole lot of sense. So the Austrian school has been growing in popularity in the last 20 years, just kind of exploding, and now we need to keep it doing that. But, you know, it furthers our argument, you know, because there is no more Soviet Union, right? And I think we can say that it was a bit more than just Reagan saying, tear down this wall, right? That's the Sean Hannity approach. What caused it? Well, Reagan said, tear down this wall, and boop, that was it. Over. Well,
he said it, but it must be true.
Must be true. Okay.
I will
try.
The cost of labor is not calculated on the supply side. Also, subjective is what you mean.
The cost of labor.
It's really the value of the mind of the consumer, but not necessarily the cost.
I think I was talking about the classical economists, and the classical economists were saying that the value of something is based upon the amount of labor effort put into the thing. And so...
Well, also that question is it, besides being just subjective, is it possible for it to be multifaceted, where you're being subjective as well as entertaining the cost of the labor as well? I'm wondering if it's multidimensional versus...
Okay, so you're asking if the cost of me buying this Mountain Dew, right? Is that where you're going?
Or even producing the Mountain Dew.
The cost of producing the Mountain Dew. Well, okay. Now here's the dilemma. It's when we're talking about cost, right? If I go to purchase it as a demander, I'm looking at the cost of purchasing this Mountain Dew and what are my foregone opportunities. And then if I'm the producer of Mountain Dew, I'm looking at the cost of making it, but that's in terms of the foregone opportunities of those resources, the opportunity cost of the water, the sugar, the aluminum, and such, that I have to bid away from my rivals, right? And they might not be in the soda industry. Right, because aluminum could be used in, say, airplanes, right? So I have to bid it away from its next best use. And so what we see then is that...
The cost of the labor anyway? Isn't
that a way... Well, I have to bid the labor away from its next best use. And so...
It's objectivist labor?
Maybe I'm not quite following your question, but in order to bid a worker away from his current job, right... My bidding him from his current job, that's his opportunity cost, is his current job, right? So I have to pull him out of that. I have to give him enough remuneration in order to pull him out of that, right? So that's, and then if I pay him, say, $50,000 a year, what's what else could I do with that $50,000 to get that worker? Right? Maybe that $50,000 I could have put into a capital project or something, right? So the cost of getting that worker is not being able to do this capital project. And then if I'm looking at it from the worker's point of view, it's like, well, if I'm working, making, you know, whatever I am doing in this job, making this sort of remuneration, and then I jump over to this other place of employment, from my point of view, what is my foregone opportunity? So it's basically opportunity costs everywhere, and they're unavoidable. And so we need to separate the word price from cost. Okay, that's I think where we conflate price with cost far too much. But I'm very specifically meaning opportunity cost, right? Foregone opportunity when I'm talking about cost. Okay. In the back. Backity back. Davenport and Wicksteed and reservation demand and reservation price. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is related. Yeah. It's that sort of looking at the subjective and the subjective. Right? Right. Well, the other school, if you look at their formation of their demand curves, they start with two goods, X and Y, and they say that they are infinitely divisible, and that we have preferences that are complete and transitive and convex to the origin and such. And we map in these utility curves onto a coordinate plane, and then we have a productivity trade-off of so much X versus so much Y, and we find the tangency of that, and then we change that price, so the slope between the two, and when we do price and quantity in our Marshallian demand curves down below, we get some sort of downward sloping curve, it's some sort of strange Giffen good thing, you know. But that's what they're doing, is they're mapping a utility function onto an objective trade-off of goods and services.
So objective would be one versus another. Right? In terms of another, rather than there's
Yes. The objective is in terms of this versus that. And
it could be anything versus one versus
another. Right, and the idea of opportunity cost is it's my next best foregone alternative. And we can't map that. We can't put that on that XY plane.
Even in aggregate?
How do you aggregate it? How do you aggregate a Mountain Dew with a Chevrolet? Right. Okay, go ahead.
Alright, I'm gonna completely change gears,
Okay.
With the current economic issues and then the result of backlash for the media and the Obama administration towards free market ideals, how do you think that will affect promotion of all this and the acceptance of, you know, Austrian and free market ideas?
So your question is with the economy tanking and the socialists on the rise and the Obama administration criticizing free markets, how's Bombavirk, Visor, and Menger going to fare?
Yes.
Well, I think they'll fare quite well. Look, you have to judge Menger, Bombavirk, and Visor by the quality of their ideas. Right? What are they saying? How logical does it hold? Does it withstand the test of scrutiny? And you know, they've been around for 130 years now, almost. So does Menger hold up to scrutiny over 130 years? Do people still read it and find him relevant and insightful? And the answer is yes. So then you come to a political, you know, position. How do you convince other people that our side is right? And that's a completely different question. But, you know, if you have the truth on your side, you know, we're going to win. I hope. I don't know how else to answer that sort of question. I mean, I think they're relevant. I think they're going to survive. Okay. Oh, wait, you already asked one, didn't you?
Yeah.
All right, I'll let you ask another one.
If price is determined by supply and demand, then what about data or intellectual property?
What about them?
Well, you can get it, like, anyone can have it, and there's no, like, supply issue. So, should it have a price, and, like, how does that fit into it?
So the question is there scarcity with intellectual property?
Sure, or should there be?
Or should there be? Well, I've written a paper on intellectual property rights. It's a working paper published at or posted, I should say, at the Mises Institute, Mises.org, and it's had some varied response to it. So you could take a look at my personal opinion, and I kind of think that there is such a thing as intellectual property, that it's not completely scarceless. I don't remember. It was like 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, and I haven't come back to it because hurt my feelings. That Sheldon Richman guy savaged me, but he hasn't convinced me either. But I can tell you that Bombalvert looked at the same issue, and he approached it from a law perspective, a legal perspective. And he says that there's nothing that we can draw the right around, right? There's no, you know, substance to sort of sink into it. And that's in this book here, Shorter Classics of Bombalvert, and I can even show you the here's the title of it. It says, whether legal rights and relationships are economic goods. Right? So, and that was written in, what year was this written in? 1881. So 1881, he comes out against intellectual property rights. So that's another reason why I think we should read the old guys, because are what they're saying still relevant? Yeah. I mean, look at it, you know, who would have ever thought? MP3 players and 1881 Bombalvert. Okay.
Can you just clarify something real quick? When you were using your Mountain Dew example,
I love my Mountain Dew example,
you said,
yes.
You said the cost was the second best choice. Wouldn't the cost, and not the dollar, wouldn't the cost be the sum of the two? The direct cost?
It is the cost that I incur is the next best thing that I could do, but I'm unable to do. All right, so if I spend my dollar and get the Mountain Dew, that means I'm not able to get the next best thing, which might be a bag of chips. And so my cost for this particular example would be the bag of chips.
Gotcha, because I guess the way it was explained to me was that the direct cost, and I mean, maybe it's just a different term, but is the opportunity cost, or I'm sorry, the total cost is the opportunity cost plus the direct cost. So it's actually the sum of the two.
It would be the bag in the bag of chips plus the dollar, but that sort of misses the point, right? Because the dollar would have been gone either way,
right?
You're double counting there. So all right, Ben is saying that's the end. I will be here through Friday, so you can ask me questions throughout the week, and I will see you guys later.